So continue on with the word of the Buddha. And we, last week, we were going through the five khandhas. And those five khandhas are what make up what we call a human being. And I did mention the first four khandhas of body, feeling, perception, and I think also mentioned the mental formations, and pointed out that the mental formation, the sankhara, which was pointed out or centered upon, was chetana, the will. So I emphasize that because that's one of the most important parts of the mental formations. Remember, it's will. So you understand what will actually is, and later on we see that it's impermanent, not me, not mine, not a self, and it's suffering, which is an important thing, a part of my teachings, to emphasize. Willing is suffering. Striving, doing, choosing, is a pain in the neck, and the rest of the body and mind as well. And lastly, I just mentioned in brief about the group of consciousness, the vijnana khanda. And I think I just mentioned the first paragraph there. What now is consciousness? This is on page 9. And there are six classes of consciousness. Consciousness of form, sounds, odors, tastes, body impressions, and mental objects. In other words, a different type of consciousness for each of the six sense bases. And in Buddhism, we make the very strong point that these are totally separate, as will be seen in a few moments at the bottom of this page. But first of all, we're focusing upon the conditionality of consciousness. There's not something which pre-exists anything. You need causes to create and generate consciousness. So consciousness is not just there all the time waiting. Consciousness is created by causes. It arises through causes. So now we have the dependent origination of consciousness. And we use just the I to begin with. Now, though one's I be intact, if the external forms not fall within the field of vision, and no corresponding conjunction of the I and its objects take place, in that case there occurs no formation of the corresponding aspect of consciousness. So you've got an eye is okay, but in a dark room, for example, then you don't see anything. Two, or though one's eye be intact and the external forms fall within the field of vision, yet if no corresponding conjunction takes place, in that case also there occurs no formation of the corresponding aspect of consciousness. So you may be walking down the road, but you know, listening to the latest iPod talk of Ajahn Brahm, and you walk into a lamppost, because you know, you're not really paying attention. The lamppost has always been there, your eyes have been open, but you're paying no attention. So that's an example of the eyes intact, external forms fall within the field of vision, but there's no corresponding conjunction of those two. So there's no formation of the eye consciousness or sight. If, however, one's eye is intact, and the external form falls within the field of vision, and the corresponding conjunction takes place, in that case, there arises the corresponding aspect of consciousness. So you can see you need the object, you need the sense space, and you need the coming together of the two to give rise to consciousness. And it may sound pedantic, but that analysis of sense consciousness has huge implications, as we now see. Hence, I say, the arising of consciousness, each six types of consciousness, not just one consciousness, the arising of each type of consciousness is dependent upon conditions. And without these conditions, no consciousness arises. And upon whatsoever condition the arising of consciousness is dependent, after that is called. So the consciousness whose arising depends on the eye and forms is called eye consciousness or sight. Consciousness whose arising depends on the ear and sounds is called hearing or ear consciousness. Consciousness whose arising depends on the olfactory organ, not just the nose, but things inside the nose, And odours is called smell or nose consciousness. Consciousness is arising, depends on the tongue and taste, is called tongue consciousness or taste. Consciousness whose arising depends upon the body, bodily contacts, is called body consciousness, or usually called feelings. And consciousness whose arising depends upon the mind and mind objects is called mind consciousness. So there's six different types of consciousness. And as I've mentioned, I think, last week, and I've emphasized in my talks, the reason why that there is something similar in all of those five senses, and also in the sixth sense, it's usually because when we say we see something, then we know we saw it. When we hear something, we know we heard. When we feel a sensation, yeah, I know I felt that. So usually each one of those first five senses, as far as five sense consciousness, is followed immediately by mind consciousness. So it gives it a sameness, something which is similar, which means a lot of time we think that seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is similar. Now what do they have in common? It's a great sort of thing to figure out. What, you know, feeling with the body and seeing and hearing, what do they have in common? There's something in common there. What is in common is the mind. It takes hold of it. But in particular, by themselves, they're totally different. And that's why a long time ago, I gave my fruit salad simile. It's very hard to get similes for these things. You have to invent them yourself, or you find that the Buddha was there before you invented them. So the fruit salad simile is that for every conscious type of consciousness, for every six consciousnesses, I gave a little fruit. So the eye, I said an apple of the eye. And for the ear, I think I used not a fruit, but a vegetable, a cauliflower, cauliflower ear. For nose, a banana. For a smell, a durian, because that stinks. Oh, no, that's actually the nose, isn't it? For taste, that's right, taste was a mango, because I like mangoes. And for physical feeling, what do you have for that? For touch?
Pineapple.
A pineapple, okay, pineapple, because that's very spiky. And lastly, for mind, coconut, because that's my big head. So, having that fruit simile, so an apple stands for seeing, a sort of a cauliflower stands for hearing, a banana stands for smelling, a mango stands for tasting, a pineapple stands for feeling with the body, and a coconut for mental consciousness, for knowing. Then what actually happens is like you have like a mango and then a coconut immediately afterwards. So the mango actually totally vanishes and is replaced by a new fruit, sort of a coconut. And then you have like banana appears and that totally vanishes and another coconut. And then maybe you have a coconut and another coconut. And then you may have sort of a pineapple and then a coconut. And it's because you have these different fruits appearing, vanishing and another one appearing and vanishing. Because the coconut is always getting involved in there, it does give a sense of sameness and continual flow rather than discrete moments of consciousness. That sameness gives a sense of like the consciousness is actually flowing. There's something always there. But in reality, it's coconut, then mango, coconut, banana, and then coconut, another banana and coconut, another banana and coconut, and then pineapple coconut. So that's a simile there. But even more interesting than that, it actually says that all these types of consciousness, that they arise when these two things come together, the sense base, the sense object, and they come together, and that gives rise to this consciousness. It generates a consciousness. So consciousness is not pre-existing before any of these conditions. So, where would the original consciousness come from? It comes can't come from anywhere. It's a myth. Because consciousness is generated, is created, is dependent. All the types of consciousness. It's actually because it's conditioned and generated, that's why it can cease. It arises and passes away, just like anything else. So there's no original, eternal, cosmic consciousness. Everything is conditioned. Yes?
So, like, if you wouldn't have a nose, you wouldn't know, and nobody would talk about, you know, the motor effect, right?
Yeah.
So, like, well, some stuff, like, exists, even though we don't know about it, right?
Yeah.
Well, how can we then see, and, you know, like, if, you know, if you meditate, and then you, like, it appears.
Well, you need it, yeah, you need to have sort of whatever sense base, you need the sense base, you need that object is there. So the object is there, but the sense base hasn't come to the sense base yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well,
yeah. It's got to sort of come together. Mm. But the point is that the arise consciousness arises because of causes. It's something which is created moment to moment, not by a God, not by a will. It just actually creates manis. Well, will is part of it in the sense that you refer to, you look at the object, or you attend to the sound, but it comes up, and that's such an important part of the Buddha's teaching, because that shows that these two things, which I keep on pointing out, are the last refuges of your sense of self, the will and consciousness. And that's sankhara, the chaitanya, the will, volitions. And now, consciousness. That's where most people sort of think they exist. And if his consciousness is dependent, it arises because of causes. Where the hell does that leave you? It leaves you in real problem that you're not. Nobody land. Yeah, that's a very good way. Nobody land. In emptiness. Yeah.
For example, if there's a stranger here to listen for a sound, that the sound is actually a tiger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's it, because what you're hearing actually is not real silence, it's just the background noise. Because there's a lot of difference between hearing silence and not hearing anything at all. Because silence is actually a sound. What we say is silence. You know, the vibrations of the air, there's always something there. But actually, when the sound turns off totally, that's very, very different. It's similar to that experience. Meditating, you close your eyes, you see blackness. See that blackness there, there's nothing much going on. And after a few moments, just you don't see anything at all. Sight is actually turned off. It's the same with sound. What we say is silence, so actually we're still hearing silence. So the hearing hasn't turned off yet. When the hearing turns off, now that's silence. That's no hearing at all. That make sense?
So the sound object still exists,
oh yeah.
Very
so the sound object exists, but you're not paying attention to it. Just like my lamppost simile. The lamppost exists, and you walk into it, but you're not paying any attention to it. So you know you're listening. Your eyes are opening, but you're listening, and you don't see it. So it's there, but because your eyes are open, because those two don't meet. Yeah.
You don't hear anything.
Yeah, well, you're going to hear something. But if you're like looking for a sound which doesn't exist.
So there is no conjunction.
No conjunction. Does that make sense? I don't know if I really understood your question, but the main point here anyway is that you need two things, or actually two things, and they're coming together, three things, to create consciousness.
I think the question is, if you're looking for a sound and it is absent, does hearing consciousness arise?
No, because if you're listening for that particular sound, there's other sounds will come in by its instead. So in other words, I'm looking for Nicholas. I haven't seen Nicholas. Where's Nicholas? I see other people. So other people just come into your field of consciousness. So just because you have will, doesn't necessarily create what you want to see or what you want to hear or what you're looking for. As soon as you've got your ears open, your eyes open, and things come into it, that generates eye consciousness. Does that make sense? Sort of. Okay, have a think about it. But the main point again is consciousness is not pre-existing. Yeah? I think, you know, what actually happens is, and this is again, keeps making this point, some people argue with me, that when you've just got pure mind consciousness, which is one of the experiences of jhanas, you get to know what just this sixth sense base truly is, and the consciousness which arises from that. Because it's not tainted with these other five senses. Before that, you only knew sort of eye and mind, ear and mind, smell and mind, and taste and mind, and touch and mind. And those two were so close together you couldn't distinguish them. But then once you knew what pure mind was in the jhanas, then you could actually notice, oh, you can actually see this other thing which is added on to seeing, this other thing which is added on to sort of hearing, this mind consciousness. You can actually just see pure coconut. So this apple coconut, you can actually separate it out. This is apple, this is coconut. You knew what pure coconut was. So that's actually one of the reasons why you can actually see sort of this whole process of discrete moments of consciousness, or rather events of consciousness arising, following after each other.
What's
being missed
at that
point? Oh, it's still the conscious process. Process, but it's actually usually misperceiving everything. So the perception is conditioned through delusions, through ignorance, or avijja. So you're misperceiving everything. Yeah, it's all sorts of things. So the permanent nature of things, so that they're yours. Again, you just take one aspect of that experience, you don't see everything else. Take the scary part of it, you don't see all the other parts of it. So it is a sort of an unbalanced perception. I think it's because most of the errors in perception come through the mental proliferation called thinking. And when you sort of ground yourself in physical feelings, you know, at least you've got something which is much more simple and more real. You're not going off into sort of thoughts and fantasies and dreams and delusions of mind. But anyway, so question over here? Okay, so the main point here is to see that these things arise and they pass away. And again on page 10, whatsoever, this is just say, whatsoever there is of corporality, on that occasion that belongs to this group of corporality. Whatsoever there is of feeling, this belongs to the group of feeling. Whatsoever there is of perception, that belongs to the group of perception, the sanyakanda. Whatsoever there are mental formations, these belong to the group of mental formations. Whatsoever there is of consciousness, this belongs to the group of consciousness. So there's nothing outside of these things, which is conscious, which is formation, which is feeling, which is perception, which is body. There's nothing outside of these. So whatsoever exists, this sort of stuff is within the khandhas. So there can't be some type of consciousness outside the khandhas. There can't be some sort of will outside the khandhas. There can't be some sort of perception outside the khandhas. So what the Buddha is saying. Very, very careful here, realizing just what sometimes people say is, well, you know, there might be sort of a mind outside of the khandhas. How can you mean that? It can't have any consciousness, it can't have any will, it can't have any perception or feeling. Because if it has any of those things, it's in the khandhas. This is what the Buddha is saying here. So it's just trying to block off all these exits, all these escape routes where people want to try and find a self outside of the khandhas. So if there is anything outside the khandhas, it's not conscious, it's got no will, doesn't perceive anything, doesn't feel anything, neither happiness nor suffering. So it's pretty meaningless. Yes, first of all, Scott? Yeah?
When we say that the Sutra is a numerical discourse, it's also about Nibbana, and it's the perception that there's no more becoming, and then it's replaced by another perception that there's no more becoming.
Oh yeah, it's not becoming, the word is being. No more being, no more existence. Yeah, that's before Parinibbana happens. Perceived as no more existence. It's ending. Gone. So once actually the Parinibbana happens, this is Nibbana. When a person becomes enlightened, when they become Arahat, they call that Nibbana with something remaining, with the candles remaining. It's called Sat Parisesa Nibbana. Sat means with Parisesa remaining Nibbana. And that's the Arahat who still has the five khandhas. And that Parinibbana, that's at the end of the Arahat's life, that's called At Parisesa Nibbana, with nothing at all remaining. That's what it means, Parisesa, nothing remaining. That's why it's called Parinibbana, complete cessation. Pari means complete, all around, total. Sense base.
Something that is set, or consciousness, like in the jhana realm, let's say,
what's the heaven of family, she's a
bliss.
The? What's she's a bliss? Yeah, the object is the bliss.
Isn't the bliss not something, it's just a because...
It's a mental object.
Is it?
Yeah. So you need a mental object for the mind to exist.
I thought, just understanding,
because
things disappear, and because of the
pleasure
of dukkha, but the bliss,
we
understand
that... It's a thing. Yes, because the mind can take up all sorts of incredible objects. So as long as it's an object, and especially if it's happy, it can feed the mind.
Is it just consciousness by...
No, consciousness by its nature is dukkha, because we're going to find out in a moment. Okay, it's come because you've got yourself very, very still. You've overcome something, and that bliss remains for a long time. Because it's subtle, because it's very still, it can last for a huge number of time, a huge amount of time. So that's actually why it's stable. Especially because things like the will has disappeared. For the mind consciousness.
So it's something that arises.
Yeah, so the bliss and the mind consciousness, they come into each other's field, and that creates this mental consciousness of the jhana consciousness.
It
arises, but it stays a long time before it disappears. But it has to disappear. If it arose, it has to disappear. Yeah. And that's actually what feeds, it's another important thing, that feeds the consciousness. It's a nice little way of calling it, an ahara. It's like a sustains the consciousness. If there wasn't any bliss there, it wouldn't sustain very long. So there's nothing outside of those candles it's saying over here. And not only this, this is the next paragraph. It's very, very powerful. And it is impossible, okay, impossible, not it may be, but impossible, that anyone can explain the passing out of one existence and the entering into a new existence of growth, increase in development, of consciousness, independently of corporeality, feeling, perception, and mental formations. So you can't have consciousness without these other things. In other words, if you have consciousness, you have to be consciousness of something. And it has to be associated with a corporeality, but in a sense, in the arupa realms, there's no real corporeality there. But there's always feeling, perception, and mental formations. So if you have consciousness, you have to have Vedana. You have to have happiness, suffering, or in between. If you have, you also have to have some perception and some mental formation there. So you can't sort of have one candle without the other. You can't have like, what is it called, unbounded consciousness, or consciousness which is free of Vedana which is free of perception, which is free of mental formations. They all come together. And that is actually that sheaf of Ri's one. Consciousness, and they call it Nama-rupa. If you take one away, the other one falls away. So you can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. If your brain's dead, you're very often if you really are brain dead, you have already died, basically, and you've gone off to a new birth. But there is those other vegetative states where you're not really brain dead, you're in a coma. So sometimes those people in comas, they can actually see, they can hear, they can feel what's going on, but they can't tell you about it. So there's those examples recently of getting these guys on a CT scan of their brain and just getting them actually to talk, but just by thinking either spatially or thinking either playing a tennis match or going for a walk in the forest. And different parts of your brain light up. And so that was the yes-no. And so, okay, if you want to say yes, think about you walking through the forest. If you want to say no, think you're playing tennis. And they started asking the person and getting consistent answers. So the guy was actually being able to communicate with people, and they realized he wasn't in his brain dead after all. He was actually able to communicate. He could actually hear what was going on, what was being said and done. It was actually amazing. Just they found a way of communicating through a CT scan. So,
what is nihilism then in terms of denial of what aspect of the consciousness?
Nihilism is basically, it's usually what is translated as nihilism here is usually the sense that everything is destroyed at death and nothing is left at all. Like, it's almost like a destruction of an existing thing. So, that's why one of the suttas in the Sanyutta is a very powerful sutta, and that was the one which was taken up by Nagarjuna to found the Majjhima creed of Buddhism. That's where the Buddha said, you can't say there is nothing, because an arising is here. You can't say there's something, because a passing away is here. It's the same as in mathematics, a point. A point, you know, it's got no extension, it's got no size. So in one extent it doesn't exist. But it's not nothing, it's actually there. So this wonderful idea of like consciousness arising and passing away again. Because it arises, there's something there. And we know there's something there. You can listen to me, you can feel me. Because it changes so quickly, so immediately, there isn't nothing persisting. Come together and passing away again. Beep, 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 beep. So there's something there, but it doesn't persist. The Buddha called that the middle way between existence and non-existence. You might call it between persistence, which is more accurate.
So that means there is that fruit salad, but there is huge gaps between the fruit.
Exactly, yeah. And the fruit is of us.
Just like all matter.
All matter, yeah. Even like in science and quantum physics. Just things just coming together and just passing away again. Yeah.
So is that what they mean when they say this is like either there's neither existence or non-existence?
Correct, yeah. So it's just a come together, it's in between. And the Buddha actually says, it's not existence, not existence. The in between is dependent origination, it's causal process. Causes come together and you get this phenomena. Causes vanish because of impermanence, phenomena disappears. So you come together because of causes, you just disappear again, like a flickering flame. Now you're bright, now you're dark. Now my meditation is brilliant, a huge fire. And now it's just sort of almost gone out. It's like any flame. Yeah. No, it says here the mind is radiant only when it's in that state, when the defilements aren't coming in.
And then the radiant kind of, or the, and then that, with whatever, it arrives. It's not like it's always there.
Correct.
It just arrives.
Correct, yeah.
And above the, that sign, that granular nature,
yeah.
That
Indeed. That's a good, it's the quantum nature of consciousness. If it's too short an exposure, you can't see anything. It's just that the mind can take any of these objects. So because it takes the object, it follows the object of the previous, say, eye consciousness, and interprets it all by itself. So the eye sees the coconut, and then the mind sees it. Yeah, but the spirit doesn't go that much further. It was just. Yes, right. Because sometimes, when you get a simile, it only applies in a certain part of the experience.
No, but like how one moment affects another, the causality, how things affect each
other. That's right, yeah. Well, actually, that is something different, because that is actually sometimes that some of the conditionality of perception and conditionality of will, just how that will just drives this process. Many times, so you start to see what you want to see, and you don't sort of experience what you hate experiencing. So that's another sort of totally different sort of aspect of this. So maybe not go into that one now. But we will go into the three characteristics of existence. So all sankharas are transient, anicca. And this is the word sankhara, and in that sense that every one of those five khandhas are also in that sense sankhara. In other words, they come into being, they're formed, they're created, they're generated. That's the meaning of a sankhara. From conditions you get the effects, that's called a sankhara. So they're all transient. Just the coconuts, transient coconuts, not always there. And all sankharas, this is a mistake here, it's not subject to suffering, it just says suffering. Sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha. So that's a mistake calling it subject to suffering, they are suffering. So when they come into...
But the mind is... How come it's suffering if you're in the...
Ah, that's amazing to actually understand that that's suffering. Because the second jhana is the most blissful experience in the world. When you get to the third jhana, you think, wow, that sucks. Second jhana. That's right, yeah. And all things are anatta, without a self. Instead of without a self, they're not self. They're not me, not mine, not a self, not a soul. That's almost like a catechism of Buddhism. All sankharas are impermanent, transient. All created things, sankharas, are dukkha. And all things are anatta.
That happens to be such an important factor.
It is an important factor, but too much happiness, you just end up being a deva and never see anything, enjoying yourself too much. Some suffering means that it sort of motivates you. Something's going on here. So that's why I said last week, sort of the human realm is supposed to be, on average, not for everybody, but on average, 50% suffering, 50% happiness. So that's a great place to get enlightened.
I think it's a question where that happiness leads. I mean, if it leads to letting go.
Yeah. If it's happiness born of letting go, especially. Yes. The best type of happiness. Okay, let's get going. We've only done a page and a half. Corporality is transient. Feeling is transient. Perception is transient. Mental formations are transient. Consciousness is transient. Or anicca. So all the five khandhas are transient. And that which is transient is suffering. Not subject to suffering, is suffering. Why? Isn't it nice, sort of, variety is the spice of life? I was taught this. Okay, so things being transient is happiness.
That's unreliable.
It would be terrible to have just the same food every day. To hear the same jokes every time. Which you do anyway, so you're suffering.
It's the case that it's not here, what's
it? You is suffering, yeah. So because it's transient, it's because we want sort of happiness to last forever and ever and ever. We can't do that. So that which is transient is actually suffering. Now that which is transient and suffering and subject to change, for I cannot rightly say, this belongs to me, this I am, this is myself. Because if it belonged to me, I would have power over it. It didn't need to be transient. If it was mine, I could tell it to do what I wanted it to do. Don't stop. So this is the thing, that what belongs to you, you have control over. That's what belonging means. If it's yours, you have ownership. You can control it. And because you can't control it, means it doesn't belong to you. The reason why you can't say, this is me, this am I, is because it keeps on changing. Which one was you? When it was there, when it was gone. Which one was you? You can't say, this is the soul. Especially the idea of a soul, an entity, a permanent being. And it comes with certain conditions on it. It has to be blissful. Imagine if your soul was that suffering and painful. That would be intolerable. That's your eternal being who's suffering. Only weird people would think that. Only weird people would think that. Now the idea of a soul, even like in the Abrahamic religions, is something which is pure and beautiful because it comes from the divine, it comes from the ultimate. It has to be sort of free of suffering, free of imperfection. It can't be the essence of existence. Whatever you think about that, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
So this is not myself. So that's actually using the five candles, and because of their impermanence and suffering, you can see that this not meant nothing to do with me. And especially that I've really emphasized, because you can't control them, that means they're nothing to do with you. Like we say, it's not my business. If it really was mine, I could control this. If this was really my monastery, I could run this monastery and control it. But of course, you can't do that. If it was really your body, you should be able to control the thing. But you can't. So it doesn't belong to me. So your body belongs to nature. Cause and effect, that's all. So it's nice that it's not my body. It's not my will either. Totally conditioned. And it's not my my consciousness, that too is conditioned. Now we've got the Anatta doctrine. Now this is not such a bad commentary by Vinayata Loka. Individual existence, as well as a whole world, are in reality nothing but a process of ever-changing phenomena, which are all comprised in the five groups of existence, the five khandhas. This process has gone on from time immemorial, before one's birth, and also after one's death it will continue for endless periods of time, as long and as far as there are conditions for it. As stated in the preceding text, the five groups of existence, either taken separately or combined, in no way constitute a real ego entity or subsisting personality. And equally, no self, soul or substance can be found outside of these groups as their owner. Said elsewhere, you can't say there's a self which owns these things. In other words, the five groups of existence are not self, nor do they belong to a self. In view of the impermanence and conditionality of all existence, a belief in any form of self must be regarded as an illusion. Just as what we designate by the name of chariot has no existence apart from axle, wheel, shaft, body, and so forth. Or as the word house is merely a convenient designation for various materials put together after a certain fashion so as to enclose a portion of space, and is no separate house entity in existence. In exactly the same way, that which we call a being or an individual or a person or by the name I is nothing but a changing combination of physical and psychical phenomena and has no real existence in itself. This, in brief, the Anatta doctrine of the Buddha. the teaching that all existence is void or empty, sunya, of a permanent self or substance. It is a fundamental Buddhist doctrine not found in any other religious teaching or philosophical system. And that's really true, that in all the other systems there's always a self, even in Hinduism, just the Atman merging with the Brahman. It's very much as a self there, very refined, perhaps one of the most refined forms of a self, but still a self there. To grasp it fully, not only in abstract and intellectual way, but by constant reference to actual experience, is an indispensable condition for the true understanding of the Buddha Dhamma and for the realization of its goal, enlightenment. The Anatta doctrine is a necessary outcome of the thorough analysis of actuality undertaken, e.g. in the Kanda doctrine, of which only a bare indication will be given by means of the text included here. Now we get the beautiful similes. Suppose a person who was not blind beheld the many bubbles on the Ganges as they drove along, or used like foam, and they watched them carefully and examined them. Then after they had carefully examined the foam on the Ganges, they would appear to him empty, unreal, and unsubstantial. In exactly the same way does the monk behold all corporal phenomena. Feelings, perceptions, he's got other similes. Whether it be the past, the present, or the future, far or near. He watches the foam, he watches the body, examines it carefully, and after carefully examined it, it appeared to him empty, void, and without a self, just like foam on the Ganges. That was a simile for the body. And for feeling, the simile was a raindrop, pop, on a puddle. Arises for a moment and then totally gone. Very similar to that lovely poem by Robert Burns. Pleasures are like poppies spread. You pluck the flower and the bloom is shed. Or like the snowfall in the river, white for a moment and gone forever. So imagine like a snowfall sort of in a lake. Or in a sort of a river. You can see it white pop and it's gone because it dissolves immediately. And the Buddha's simile was like the raindrop in a puddle. A pop and it's gone. A discrete moment of Vedana. And you all know, remember the simile for perception which the Buddha gave? You got foam on the Ganges, is for the body. We have raindrop plopping on the puddle for feeling, and perception, how uncertain it is. Who knows? The mirage. Like seeing, like on a hot day, some water. That's what perception is. It's a mirage. It's real, that's real light coming into your eye, but you give it a meaning it doesn't deserve. Your perceptions. That was a beautiful meal we had at lunchtime today. That's the mirage. You're adding things which weren't really there. Because sometimes you like that food, and I didn't like it. And I liked some things, and you didn't like that. So where was the taste? Where was the enjoyment? Was it real? No, it's just a mirage. Sometimes people feel that it's very beautiful. Sometimes people think it's ugly. Where is the beauty in the ugliness? Just a mirage of perception. So that's a mirage. And the sankhara, the will especially. What was the Buddha's simile for the will? Plantain tree. But not many people know about a plantain tree. Plantain tree, like banana trees, it's got no pith to it. It's got no solid core. So you can't go and sort of cut one down and just, get some rafters or some wood to make a bench. So it's got no solid core to it. But good old Bhante Ji, he did one better than that. And he mentioned it was like an onion. Because an onion is also, you can peel the onion, there's nothing, no core to it. There's nothing inside. But it has the extra, two extra qualities by comparing it to an onion. Number one, it makes you cry. So will causes you a lot of suffering. And number two, he mentioned the actual word itself, anien. It goes on and on with an I in the middle of it. It's a nice little nice on and on with an I. Matthew G did that one, yeah, that's very brilliant. I think he could have got it from somewhere else, but that's where he is the recognised originator of that anien. It's nice, there's no core to the will. It's not me. But that's what it appears like. There's an I in the middle of it, the illusion of an I. And it makes you cry. The amount of times you've wanted things and you've willed and you've strived. And where's it ever left you? Just disappointed and suffering. And lastly, the consciousness.
The magician's
trick. Yeah. Coconut. Now it's gone. Now banana. Where's the banana gone? Now there's another coconut. Where did that come from? And now, see. It's like a magician's trick. That's actually what the Buddha said. But for consciousness. In other words, that's what a magician is, an illusionist. It makes you see things which aren't really there. So that's actually the Buddha's five similes. So here, it's a shame because they're great similes. They only mention the one about the phone. So just like the illusion, the magician's trick. So you watch and examine it carefully, you find it's just void. It's not really something to say. It's not a real rabbit or something. You find out what's happening. It's empty, void, and without a self. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, they did sort of disappear, yeah. Whoso delights in corporeality or feeling or perceptual mental formations or consciousness, if you delight in any of those five khandhas in any form whatsoever, you delight in suffering. Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? Just really bangs you on the head. Whatever you delight in. And whoever delights in suffering will not be freed from suffering. Because you delight in it, that's why we keep getting it. Thus I say, how can you find delight and mirth when it is burning without end? In deepest darkness you are at. Why do you not seek for the light? It's interesting, a lot of people aren't interested in understanding because they find delight in suffering. Look at this puppet here, well rigged, that's your body. A heap of many sores piled up, diseased and full of greediness, unstable and impermanent. Devoured by old age is this frame. Look at people who are older than you. A prey to sickness, weak and frail. To pieces breaks this putrid body. All life must truly end in death. Did you never see in the world a man or a woman, 80, 90 or 100 years of age, frail, crooked as a gable roof? That means, in those days, I think they used these bent pieces of wood actually for their roofs. They actually got them from the forest. And that bent, crooked, was actually the main ridge beam they used in their roof. Bent down, resting on crutches, with tottering steps, infirm, youth long since fled, with broken teeth, grey and scanty hair or none, wrinkled with blotched limbs. Have you ever seen anyone like that? And did the thought never come to you that you are also subject to decay, that you also cannot escape it? It's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Your broken teeth and blotched skin. The Zimmer frame is on order for you. Did you never see in the world a man or a woman who, being sick, afflicted and grievously ill, wallowing in his own filth, was lifted up by some and put to bed by others? And did the thought never come to you that you are also subject to disease? You cannot escape it. You may be okay today, but disease is coming. Did you never see in the world the corpse of a man or a woman, one or two or three days after death, swollen up, blue, black in colour and full of corruption? Most of you guys haven't, because they don't allow that anymore. As soon as the person dies, they shoot it up with all this embalming stuff so it doesn't go off. But, because I was a monk in Thailand 36 years ago, we could actually do this. Because we were soon told that we could go to autopsies. And because we were monks in Thailand, we were actually allowed to go into the autopsy theatre. And first year I did that, I didn't really understand where the really good autopsies were. But nevertheless, in the autopsy room at Sirirat Hospital, this is just over from Bangkok, the main hospital in Bangkok, you went into the autopsy room, no one stopped you. And I couldn't believe it, on one of the ledges, you know, for the window, letting light, there was a plate, there was a human head on top. Just like a cut off head, that's all. It's really gruesome. Not a plastic head, but a real head. They just put it on there on a plate in the window, just like a flower pot. It was really neat.
Was it on the side, or was it like
standing up? I was standing up, like, no, standing up. Just, but it was a real thing. It wasn't sort of a joke, it was just there. So, but the best place was on Monday mornings, you had to be early, just round the back, was where they did the autopsies for people they dragged out of the river. You know, they'd be, and these were like putrid, bloated, and just sort of really, really sort of like Martians. And there's no joke, this really, the doctor would come in, it was probably the doctor who'd done some bad act in the hospital, because this was like the lowest job in the whole hospital. And he literally had his long stick, maybe about 2 meters long, with a nail on the end. And we didn't know what to do, but he told us to stand back, because the first thing he had to do was actually to pop the body. Because, you know, it was bloated, had all this gas inside. And he with the stick, he'd bang it, and so to pierce the body, and all this stuff would shoot up on the ceiling. And my goodness, that really, really stank. And I'm a really tough monk, even I just, you know, keel backwards because of this. And then the doctor had to go up, you know, and just see if there was any bullet wounds or stab wounds or whatever, because he had to sort of know the cause of death. But I must admit, he didn't make much of an investigation. Just turn it over quickly, I can't see anything, and suddenly the report, because it was just disgusting. So you can actually do that these days, yes. It was in a sense, you may think it was, I mean, it's amazing just people's reaction is to laugh at such disgusting things. But it's actually a great sort of reflection to actually to see that, have that in your mind, to see what it means. If you don't actually catch the person before they die and again shoot out with embalming fluid, it rots. That's what happens to it. And it stinks. There's something about the smell of death. It's one of the worst smells. It must be conditioned into us. It's one of the most repulsive smells. More than anything else, the smell of a dying or like a dead body. And did the thought never come to you, you're also subject to death, you cannot escape it. Again, because in those places in Thailand we could have these great cremations. Most people died in Thailand, you'd actually be able to do the cremation the next day. And it was an open cremation, just a pile of wood. We get everybody actually to come up and touch the body and see a dead body. It was amazing how many Westerners who were visiting had never seen a dead body before. Certainly not touched it. It was really, really helpful, useful actually to touch a dead body. And when you actually touch it and feel it, like no embalming fluid or anything, just real, cold and grey, then it really sort of starts to sink into you that, yeah, just like this person, so me. Especially when you get someone who's the same age as you. And that really sort of hits home as well. If they're much older than you, you think, oh yeah, yeah, you know, I've got many years from like that. But when it's someone exactly the same age as you, the same gender, that sort of hits home. Now, for all the sort of the Christians who keep asking you, how did this world begin? Page 14, samsara. Inconceivable is the beginning of this samsara. Not to be discovered is any first beginnings of beings who, obstructed by delusion, ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths. So, because in Buddhism, this is like huge. It's not just one universe. You know, just, how many, was it, 14,000 million years this current universe is supposed to be old by now. That's the current age of this universe, give or take a few hundred million years. 17.5, is it? Okay. It's extended. I haven't been around that long. It was 14,000 million when I was at university. Okay, yeah. 17.5 now, is it? Okay. But anyway, that's not that long, really. But here, So this is just one universe amongst billions of universes. Just one universe cycle. So inconceivable is the beginnings of these universe cycles. Yes, old man.
What holds universes?
What holds them?
Yeah, like there's a universe here and a universe here. You know, like what are they inside of?
Nothing. Self-contained. So you can't say they're inside something. It's just like the five khandhas. There's nothing outside the five khandhas. So when there is a universe, just this universe.
But aren't there concurrent multiple universes, right?
Not concurrent, sequential. One after the other, then after another, then after another, then after another. It's a great thing about sort of science, you know, this even current universe, 17.5 billion years old. So basically that means it's got a diameter of 35 billion light years. But it's not like a sphere. It's got no edges to it. It's got a volume, a finite volume without any edges. Just like the simile of the ant crawling on the football. It's crawling around the basketball. It's crawling around a basketball. Now the basketball's got a certain area. It's got no edges to it. It goes round and round and round and round and round. Just like this universe. It goes on and on and on and on. And on and on. No end to the ants tour around the baseball. It never finds an end nor a beginning.
I was reading this book by Stephen Hawking called The Universe in a Nutshell.
Yeah.
He talks about universes that, you know, like expand and contract.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't say whether they contract.
Yeah.
But then he said there were also universes that were so, that like started and then expanded so much that they just like flew apart, and then there were universes that like arose and then like just crashed right in on themselves.
Yeah.
And those are all sequential.
Yeah, many ones. So many ones didn't quite make it.
But it's not like there's hundreds of them around. It's just the one that we're in right now that keeps doing that. And sometimes it just crashes back in on itself.
Yeah, now maybe the next one might crash in on itself. Maybe another one will sort of expand too quickly. And when one comes, which is just right, then beings get reborn into it. So anyway, the most important thing here is inconceivable is the beginning. This goes on and on and on, an infinite sequence. It will never end. So the idea of a God, a creator, is totally irrelevant. An endless cycle, which is really the only logically beautiful answer to the beginning of a universe. Of no beginning, of endless. Yes. No, keep it simple, in other words, yeah.
Right. So if we're trying to understand
things... It's still okay to understand, yeah.
Huh?
It's okay to understand, but to understand what's really important to understand. Yeah. So the reason why it's saying inconceivable is the beginning is number one, to stop you even trying to think about that, because it's impossible to. But also, as we're seeing soon, just to give you an idea of the whole scope of this thing we call rebirth, to give you what we call the big picture. Samsara, the wheel of existence, literally the perpetual wandering, that's what samsara means, perpetual wandering. There's a name given in the Pali scriptures to the sea of life, ever restlessly heaving up and down, and the symbol of this continuous process of ever again and again being born, growing old, suffering and dying. Being born, growing old, suffering and dying. Being born, growing old, suffering and dying. More precisely put, samsara is the unbroken sequence of the fivefold khandha combinations, which constantly changing from moment to moment, follow continually one upon the other through inconceivable periods of time. Of this samsara, a single life constitutes only a tiny fraction. Hence, to be able to comprehend the First Noble Truth, one must let one's gaze rest upon the samsara, upon this frightful sequences of uncountable rebirths, and not merely upon one single lifetime, which of course may sometimes be not very painful. The term dukkha in the First Noble Truth refers therefore not merely to painful bodily and mental sensations due to unpleasant impressions. It's not just the body and mentally pain, but it comprises in addition everything productive of suffering or liable to it. The truth of suffering teaches that owing to the universal law of impermanence, even high and sublime states of happiness, such as jhanas, are subject to change and destruction, that all states of existence are therefore unsatisfactory without exception, carrying themselves as seeds of suffering for the future. What do you think is more? The flood of tears which weeping and wailing you have shed upon this long way, hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths, united with the undesired, separated from the desired. What is more, the flood of tears or the waters of the four oceans? Have you ever wondered why the ocean water is salty? Now you know. The flood of tears is much more. Long have you suffered the death of father and mother, of sons, daughters, brothers and sisters. Actually, we just found out that Nito's father died today. See? It's real. What is more, the flood of tears. Long have you suffered the death of father and mother, here we go again, of sons, daughters, brothers and sisters. And whilst you were thus suffering, you have indeed shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four oceans. Which do you think is more? The streams of blood that through your being beheaded, just that amount, have flowed upon this long way. These are the waters of the four oceans. Long have you, Nicholas, been caught as a robber. Long have you, Buddha Rakata, been caught as a highwayman. Long, who's going to say he's the adulterer? I'm stopping. And through your being beheaded, verily more blood has flowed upon this long way than there is water in the four oceans. But how is this possible? Because inconceivable is the beginning of this samsara. Not to be discovered is any first beginning of beings who are obstructed by delusion and snared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths. And thus have you long undergone suffering, undergone torment, undergone misfortune, and filled the graveyards full, truly long enough to be dissatisfied with all forms of existence, of bhava, long enough to be turned away and free yourselves from them all. So if you could only remember, it's how much you've been through.
But what's the four oceans?
I think that's what they thought the four oceans were before. How many oceans are there these days? Five, six, seven? Yeah, I thought it was seven oceans. Yeah.
Seven seas,
seven oceans. Yeah, that's enough. That's all they knew about in those days.
So,
sorry?
No.
Yeah, it's big enough anyway. Four is enough. Yeah?
Last week you mentioned that consciousness evolved from a plant.
Oh, yeah, but your particular consciousness. There's been many others before you and many others after you. The whole sort of sea of seeds and consciousnesses, endless beginnings, endless in the future. Even when I was a kid studying science, I thought it was really neat when they started talking about the nature of, you know, our sun. And I said, how old is that? It's only about 5 billion years, isn't it, or something? If it's that. But anyway, so in the near future, another sort of, I think another 500 million years, it's going to expand. Expand to be so big that it's going to take up the orbit of Mars. Oh, sorry, of Mercury. It's going to vaporize. What's the next one? Venus. And it's also going to vaporize us as well. So in the future, Bodhinyana Monastery, Dhammasara Monastery, all record of our human existence is going to literally just be wafted away as just vapor into the far parts of the universe. All relics, all stupas, all Buddha statues, all Tripitaka, every record of your existence, Nicholas, is going to be wiped away as if you never was at all. Really nice to know this is no such thing as permanence. Yes.
In this world system, if there are beings that be born and know that they don't exist, does that get born in other world systems?
Yeah, they can do, yes.
Okay.
It may be, because there's no other place to go. Their next lifetime be reborn as a Martian. You have a little antenna coming out of your ears. Long have you had antennae. Long have you had tentacles, Peter. But now you're in this human world. Who knows? It might happen. How's the time going? Okay, so we do a little bit more about craving. Yeah, we'll do some more about craving. The second noble truth. That's the noble truth of suffering. But please remember that last part is one of the most important parts of the truth of suffering. It's not just in this life. You may get this life pretty well organized and have a good life. But what about the next life? And the one afterwards, and the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. Have you seen the movie Groundhog Day? We have to live the same day again and again and again until it just drives him crazy. That's what rebirth is like. Same life, here we go again. How many times do you have to do this? Anyway, the second noble truth. The noble truth of the origin of dukkha. What now is the noble truth of the origin of dukkha? It is that craving which gives rise to fresh rebirth. Bound up with pleasure and lust, now here, now there, finds ever fresh delight. It's the craving which gives rise to fresh rebirth. The wanting, the delight. There are the three types of craving. The sensual craving, which is the craving bound up with the five senses. And there's a craving for existence, not internal existence. That's a handy thing. That's what we've got in bracket. The craving to be. And lastly, the craving not to be, to annihilate. Sensual craving is a desire for the enjoyment of the five sense objects, not just the enjoyment, for having five sense objects. That's the stuff which is very hard to give up, even though you're about to get into jhana, the body's about to disappear. You can't do it. Why? Because we crave just to have senses, have sense activity. Even, what was it, that's... There was a story I read a long time ago in, I think it was that Ram Dass's book, this hippie holy man many years ago. But he was one of these American gurus about 35 years ago, 40 years ago. And so he had his disciple, and his disciple's father was really sick in hospital. So she decided to get her guru to come and see the dad to teach him some Dhamma. And as soon as his American dad, like a redneck, saw this, you know, long-haired freak coming in with hippie beads, you know, he wasn't that impressed. So he didn't want to talk to him at all, but he was very glad that his daughter was there. So he was talking to his daughter, and Ram Dass saw, what can I do for this guy? He decided to give him a foot massage. And as he was giving him a foot massage, the pain, which had been constant in this man's body, suddenly disappeared. The foot massage had actually worked. The pain had actually vanished. And he was so shocked. He said, get out away from my feet. Don't touch them ever again. He'd rather have the pain and have his worldview complete and not challenged. And that's actually almost like sort of, you know, we'd rather have actually, and that was actually not really the simile I was looking for. The simile I was looking for is that sometimes people, they've been with them when they're dying and they just can't let go. They'd rather have painful sense experiences than no sense experience at all because they're afraid of not existing. They'd rather be.
Like ghosts?
Ghosts as well. The craving to be is much stronger than a craving to be happy. So if you've got a choice, from just totally disappearing, or being but having suffering. You take suffering, most people, because they just want to exist. They prefer to exist with happiness, but existing with suffering, okay, I'll take that. Rather not exist at all. Yes? It is because the sense of I, you know, that's the basic craving to have happiness and pleasure. Yeah, that's there. But the craving to be is far stronger than that. And you can actually see that, because sometimes we can't even let go of suffering, because that means we don't exist anymore. That's one of the problems why people, you know, hear about what enlightenment is and they don't want it. Because it means you can't exist anymore. So I'm not ready for that. I'd rather have my happiness and my suffering, my happiness and suffering. I'd rather suffer and just disappear totally. That's Bhava Dhamma. And again, you come across that in the deep meditations. Because, again, that's again one of the big problems of getting into a jhana. Because we attach to like our five senses. And when that disappears, that's freaky. Something which we think we are is vanishing. We just can't take that fear. Especially giving up your will. If you really think that that's who you are. That is like the craving to be and to do is so strong. And the craving to annihilate is just self-annihilate. It's just a specific type of craving. That's like the Buddha said, like a dog chasing his tail. Although my simile, from odd of a twist, about a man trying to reach his own head. Because you're trying to destroy yourself, you can't do it. That's like you trying to meditate. You can't do it. That's, you know, even if you try to meditate, that's a type of self-annihilation, we've all done that. You just got to let go of all craving, all desire, and then things disappear. You try and make them disappear, and they can't. Like eating your own head. Like chasing your own tail. Meditation sometimes is like that, people chasing their own tail. They just can't reach it, they can't get peaceful. The reason is because it's another craving. So sensual craving is a desire for the enjoyment of the five sense object. No, it's any desire in that field of sensuality. Craving for existence, the desire for continued or eternal life, referring to life in those, that's rubbish. It's all about just the craving to be. The craving for self-annihilation is just again, trying to destroy yourself. The origin of craving. But where does this craving arise and take root? Wherever in the world there are delightful and pleasurable things, there is this craving takes root. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind as well. That's where craving takes root. Whatever is delightful and pleasurable. Visual objects, sounds, smells, tastes, body impressions, and mind objects are delightful and pleasurable. There this craving arises and takes root. Consciousness, sense impression, feeling born of sense impression, perception, will, craving, thinking, reflecting are delightful and pleasurable. There this craving arises and takes root. Is consciousness pleasurable? If we actually saw what it truly is suffering, would craving take root there? If we saw that sense impressions or feelings, perception, will, thinking, if we saw that thinking was not pleasurable, would craving take root there? You only think because you want to think. And one of the reasons why you think is because we have the impression that it's pleasurable. You're going to get somewhere with thinking. What it measures pleasurable is exciting, satisfying, titillating. And actually, this is where pleasurable in the worldly sense. This is where the saying of the Buddha, what the enlightened ones say is suffering, the world says is pleasure. What the enlightened ones say is pleasurable, the world says is suffering. Like you tell your friends that you spend your holiday in Bodhinyana Monastery, just eating just one meal a day, meditating for hours on end, seeing no TV, no sort of movies. I think that's suffering. No, that was pleasurable. When you go back to work, Polio, they'll ask you, oh, where did you go? Did you go to Europe? Did you see Paris? See the Amazon? What do you do? No, I just watch my breath for the last 3 months. You're crazy. But what they say is suffering, you know it's happiness. Okay. We're going on to, oh no, to the dependent origination of all phenomena. If whenever perceiving a visual object, a sound, odour, a taste, body impression or mind object, the object is pleasant, one is attracted. If unpleasant, one is repelled. Thus, whatever kind of feeling one experiences, pleasant, pleasant or different, if one approves of it and cherishes the feeling and clings to it, then while doing so, lust springs up, but lust with feelings means clinging, and on clinging depends the present process of becoming. That is absolutely wrong. The process of becoming bhava depends future birth, and dependent on birth and decay and deaths are death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Thus arises this whole mass of suffering. Now actually what someone has actually asked me earlier, this bhava, is, now when there is a feeling, if, now this is the sensations of pleasure or pain, if one that is also accompanied by delusion, by avijja, then the craving comes up. The craving either to have fun in those five sense world, or the craving just to have that world, to be. And that is called the craving. This upadana, which comes next, you could call it clinging, but the other word for upadana is actually just fuel. It literally means, now, adana, as in adin adana, means taking. And upa actually literally means, the same in English, taking up. It means a taking up of these objects. And just like a wick takes up the oil, like the car engine takes up the gas, the petrol. This is, you take up that craving. And that's the word upadana. It's like a fueling. And on that fuel, that fuels not the process of becoming, but actually the states of existence. And actually I think in the Majjhima to convince Bhikkhu Bodhi to translate bhava as existence, because there's many places there where they have like manusa bhava, the state of existence of being a human. Tirachana bhava, the state of existence of being an animal. It's like a state of existence. So it fuels the state of existences into which one can get reborn, the jati. And once you're born, you're stuffed again. Who got up there first? Yes, go on. No, the main thing is because we think we can control all this. Yeah, we tend to think it's my pleasure, my pain, and I can do something about this.
And is that equally perceiving that mind but also
suffering?
They have equal.
Yeah, because it's suffering, because it's just, you can't have one without the other. It's just a way of perceiving, it's a view which is part of the process, a huge conditioning factor of the process of the khandhas, which has been there for a long time. So it's like a self-sustaining sort of aspect of the khandhas.
So why is it that for an Aryan, something fundamentally changes?
Called right view. So in other words, the delusion is not there anymore. So you don't see these things as me and mine, like that simile which I gave of the driverless bus. You see there's no one in the seat, there's no will anymore. So it's a waste of time complaining. So pleasure, pain, you can't control it anyway. So you just cop it sweet.
I think hear teachings like this, helps break down the living between the belief and reality of things.
It sort of lessens the power of delusion. So it weakens it until one sees it for oneself. So thus arises this whole mass of suffering. So the form of dependent origination, of which only some of the 12 links have been mentioned in the preceding passage, may be regarded as a detailed explanation of the second truth. And in fact, that's actually sometimes you see the explanation of the Four Noble Truths, and number two is dependent origination, cause of suffering. And you can see from that dependent origination, I was just looking at a paper by Ajahn Brahmani today, that dependent origination has to be sort of over many lives. So it is actually just how rebirth happens. So it's the understanding that the cause of suffering is the cause of rebirth. There was another sutra somewhere where somebody asked Sariputta, so look, I haven't got much time. What is suffering? And what is the end of suffering? And Sariputta said very beautifully, like a Zen master, rebirth is suffering. No rebirth is happiness. So that's the difference between suffering and happiness. Very beautifully put. Okay, now we get to karma. Truly, due to sensuous craving, conditioned through sensuous craving, impelled by sensuous craving, entirely moved by sensuous craving. Kings fight with kings. Prime ministers fight with leaders of the opposition. Princes with princes, priests with priests, citizens with citizens, mother with son with mother, father with son, the son with father, brother comes with brother with sister with brother, friend with friend. Have you noticed anything missing there? No, not monk with monk. We don't argue. It's amazing they haven't got wife with husband. No, look there. I mean, that's the most obvious one where there's quarrels. And there's not in there. Just because in those days, the wife was just too afraid to sort of argue. She'd get hit. So it's been unfair those days. But anyway, thus given to distension, quarreling and fighting, they fall upon one another with fists, sticks or weapons, and thereby suffer death or deadly pain, and further due to sensuous craving, conditioned through sensuous craving, impelled by sensuous craving, entirely moved by sensuous craving, people break into houses, rob, plunder, pillage whole houses, commit highway robberies, seduce the wives of others. Then the rulers have such people caught and inflict on them the various forms of punishment. And in the sutta they go into detail of the various types of punishment, like was the porridge head, the hawk, and they have all these. Those of you who are really weird, you can go and look at all these weird punishments they had in those days. I think, well, the one I remember, because you know, when you're sort of a young monk, you haven't got much to read, and you really get into this. I think they take off the top of the skull and they put this, that's the porridge pot, that's right, they put this big ball of lead or something, hot, and it goes right through the brain and then out through their mouth. It doesn't hurt, because when no, the brain has got no sort of senses in it, so it just boils the brain. That's the porridge idea. And so then they don't feel anything, that's where you die. What was the other ones? Anyone? Yeah?
I
see. That's a good thing, yeah. But anyway, if you want to see all the different types of punishments, say, you know, the weirdos devised in those days. Now, this is the misery of sensuous craving, the heaping up of suffering in this present life. Now, this is actually where the Buddha was talking about the karmic results of bad karma. The results of bad karma. You know what the word the present life actually is in Pali? It's called sanditika. Sanditika. Now, this is very important because when I was reading this the very first time, sanditika does not mean here and now. It doesn't mean in this moment, it means in this life. This is something which you can experience, you can know in this life, as opposed to what's coming next. And further, people take the evil way in deeds, the evil way in words, the evil way in thoughts, and by taking the evil way in deeds, words, and thoughts, at the dissolution of the body, after death, they fall into a downward state of existence, a state of suffering and an unhappy destiny, and the abysses of the hells. But this is the misery of sensuous craving, the heaping up of suffering in the future life, the sampalayaka, due to sensuous craving, conditions of sensuous craving, caused by sensuous craving, entirely dependent on sensuous craving. I often quote that passage to understand what sanditika means. It's not here and now, it means in this life. And that was a big mistake of that monk Jnanavira, who said the Dharma has to be sanditika. Suvakato bhagavata dhammo, sanditika, akalika, ahipasiko, panayiko, pachatang, vijitupo, vinyuhi. It's one of the attributes of the Dharma, it has to be sanditika. And he thought that meant, no, here and now, in the present moment, which means dependent origination can't be about future lives. But what sanditika means, it means what you can experience in this life. So when it says here and now in many of the suttas, it means in this life, not here and now, in this very life, as opposed to what happens in your next life. Yep? That's right, yeah. They say that the karma leads to the future destinies. But remember, it's you. The will is caused. It's not you, but because of guilt, because of your delusion, you send yourself to those unhappy destinies. And you make those unhappy destinies exactly as you feel they should be. You get what you deserve. So you make an appropriate punishment for yourself, whatever you think you did wrong. Sorry? Customized, yeah. Personalized. Yes. Yes. It's still deluded, yeah. That's right. But it's getting you closer. It's taking away all these other sort of delusions. So you say that again and again, you hear it again and again. Oh, wow, I see it now. I understand what they're talking about. Important, yeah. Correct, yeah. So, you know, you hear it, you get conditioned, but then you see it. Yeah.
Should that be used to actually bring the mind more into the moment and not to have a kind of escapism?
Yeah, it's, in a moment it's good, but as I said to someone today, like, I really believe in escapism. And people actually came along to me and said, you've become a monk to escape. I said, yes, at last somebody's understood what I became a monk for, to escape from rebirth and suffering.
Okay.
That's right, yeah. Indeed, yes. So you actually escape through the present.
Mm-hmm.
Present is one of the doorways.
Yes, that's how the teaching should be, a way of kind of bringing the mind into a state of stability, not to kind of tear it away.
Indeed, yeah. And escape through the hole in the present moment. Not in the air, nor the ocean mist, nor hidden in the mountain crests. Nowhere is found a place on earth where a person is freed from their evil deeds. Oh, your evil deeds are going to catch up with you. Unless you get enlightened soon. It is volition, will, that I call karma. Having willed, one acts by body, speech, and mind. See, it's the will which is the problem again. This thing which you keep on cherishing. You know, my will, I'm the driver. It gets you into trouble again and again. It is your karma. So imagine if you let go of will. Where will be your karma? Karma disappears. You're free. You've let go. So if you can really let go of guilt, the will to punish yourself also disappears. And the hell realms will never be visited by you ever again. There are actions ripening in hells, if you will them. Ripening in the animal kingdom. Ripening in the domain of ghosts. Ripening amongst men. Ripening in heavenly worlds. The results of actions is of three kinds. Ripening in the present life, in the next life, or in the future life. Well, of course, the fourth one, not ripening at all. That's called ahosikama. Inheritance of deeds. All beings are the owners of their karma, heirs of their karma. Their karma is the womb from which they sprang. With their karma they are bound up. Their karma is their refuge. Whatever karma they do, good or evil, of that they will be the heirs. So you are your karma. So you're the owner of your karma. Are you the owner of somebody else's karma? So if they call you a pig, why do you get upset? It's your karma to call me a pig. You're going to cop it. You're going to get it. So I don't have to do anything. So don't own anybody else's bad karma. Someone else hurts you, cheats you, mistreats you. That's their karma. Don't go stealing and breaking your second precept by taking over someone else's karma and getting upset because they've done something wrong.
So it's forgiveness really a lot of an early beginning stage of that Aryan knowledge of not having this sense of responsibility.
Responsibility and control. So forgiveness is letting go. So we're letting go of the pain of the past. Letting go of getting angry at people. Then go and get angry at yourself. Totally stupid thing to do, to get angry at yourself and angry at other people. But we can't do that because we think that we own other people.
Is that conditioning teaching of forgiveness, is that really coming from Aryans?
Yeah, for sure. That's why this is another thing which sets Buddhism aside. It's got no punitive part to it. No one ever gets punished. I think in Christianity, spare the rod, spoil the child. In Buddhism, put aside the rod. Everyone fears the rod, put it aside. That's why we liked it, no punishment. Yeah, indeed, much better society. Absolutely, yes. You don't get so fault-finding in others or yourself. You actually be happy, even though you haven't been perfect. You haven't been perfect? Okay. That's right, yeah. So when you don't have any will, no karma at all. No good, no bad, nothing to ripen. Oh yeah, you've still got to bear with your old karma. That's why they say this. They say these five senses is the result of old karma. So I have to see, I have to smell, I have to taste. That's right, you're free at last. All beings are the... Oh, I did that already. And wherever their beings spring into existence, there their deeds will ripen. And wherever their deeds ripen, there they will earn the fruits of those deeds, be in this life, in the next life, in some future lives. Sometimes it's not just one for one, you do a good act, you get many good acts, many happinesses back. Yeah, this is like a mango, from one mango you get many, many mango trees, and hundreds of mangoes. So you do a nice good act, and you get rewarded many, many times over. You do a bad, stupid act, punished again and again. Until you forgive. There will come a time when a mighty ocean will dry up, vanish and be no more. These are predicting climate change. There will come a time when the mighty earth will be devoured by fire, perish and be no more. So that's astrophysics, I've mentioned that. But yet there will be no end to the suffering of beings who are obstructed by ignorance and snared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths. Craving, however, is not the only cause of evil action and thus of all the suffering and misery produced thereby the next life. But whatever is craving, there... Not the only cause of evil action, craving. What's another cause of evil action? Yeah, it's paving. I reckon that is make-all delusion, if that's what it's meaning. But anyway, but wherever there is craving, there dependent upon craving may arise envy, anger, hatred, and many other evil things productive of suffering and misery. It means like the byproducts of craving. And all these selfish, life-affirming impulses and actions, together with the various kinds of misery produced thereby here or thereafter, and even all the five groups of phenomena constituting life, the khandhas, everything is ultimately rooted in blindness and ignorance of vijaya. The second noble truth serves also to explain the causes of the seeming injustices in nature by teaching that nothing in the world can come into existence without reason or cause, and that not only our latent tendencies but our whole destiny, all weal and woe, result from causes, karma, which we have to seek partly in this life, partly in former states of existence. These causes are the life-affirming activities produced by body, speech and mind. Hence it is this threefold action by body, speech and mind that determines the character and destiny of all beings. Exactly defined, karma denotes those good and evil volitions together with rebirth, the existence, or better, the process of becoming, that's being, consists of an active and conditioning karma process and of its result, rebirth process. Here too, when considering karma, one must not lose sight of the impersonal nature of existence. In the case of a storm-swept sea, it is not an identical wave that hastens over the surface of the ocean, but it is the rising and falling of quite different masses of water. In the same way, it should be understood that there are no real ego entities hastening through the ocean of rebirth, but merely life waves which, according to their nature and activities, manifest themselves here as men, there as animals, and elsewhere as invisible beings. Once more, the fact may be emphasized here that, correctly speaking, the term karma signifies only the aforementioned kinds of action, not the results, which is vipaka. But anyway, that's the origin of suffering, craving, which causes rebirth. So, if you want to end suffering, end rebirth. And how do you end rebirth?
End craving.
Follow the path. Very good. Excellent.